Hikki mai, kake mai. Ko mai te waiora kia hau. Kia tūtehu ana te moia, te kuia i te pō. Ka pō, ka ao, ka awatea.
Tēnā tātou katoa, nau mai, haere mai ki kia whakanui a Te Whenua Podcast. Welcome back, everyone. Welcome back to another episode. As always with me, we have Carolyn and Sarah. Kia ora.
Kia ora.
Ka whai. And today we have a very special guest. Well, all of our authors are very special guests, but today we have Fleur Palm. Kia ora.
Kia ora. Kia ora, Marcus.
Awesome. Do you mind introducing yourself, Eho? So, Nōwhia Queer, yeah, as much as you want.
Kia ora, he uri o Muri Whenua, kua tīnana, kua matātua, rātou kua māmare o ku waka, ko tarakeha te manga, ko moitangi te awa, ko mātihitihi te marae, he kai hoahonga au, he ahurangi au ki te te kura wānanga aranui o Tamaki Makaurau, ko Fleur Palmer tōku ingoa. Tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa.
Tēnā.
So I'll just introduce myself in te reo Pākehā. I affiliate to the Northern Tribes, so the Bāwhā North. Above Hokia ngā, my whenua ukaipua, the place that nourishes my soul is a place called Miti Miti in the Northern Hokianga. And I am an architect and associate professor at Auckland University of Technology.
Awesome, Iho. Amazing. I guess since you're from the north, do you go back? Since you're in Tamaki, do you go back often?
Oh, not since the COVID, actually. There were a lot of restrictions during COVID, and we're just talking about having a big visit going up there, which will probably, it's going to be in October. So we're planning a trip.
Awesome. Well, we'll get into it. Mind telling us a bit about your chapter and sort of maybe even how you came or how you got approached on writing the chapter, maybe?
Kia ora. Well, I'm part of the Ngā Oho Collective, which is a collective of designers, architects, landscape architects, ecologists, graphic designers, a whole lot of people from across the country that are interested in trying to make sure that we see Māori forms of expression in the creation of our built environments. And that's not only to do with visible things, but also values. We're wanting to make sure that we advocate for seeing our values becoming manifested in built environments. And so that the Ngā Oho is a great group of practitioners, and they developed these series of principles quite a few years ago. About 25 years ago, they began working on this, developing a series of principles known as Te Aranga principles. And a lot of my mahi is looking at advocating and working with different communities, and also in the teaching space. So especially in the teaching space, I was involved in the development of an architectural program that was influenced by or thinking about how we can re-indigenize built environments within architectural practice. So that's where I come from.
Oh, awesome, Iho. And I think a cool thing about your chapter, and I think even it's extremely relevant now, especially with the, I believe it was the Auckland anniversary floods and how that impacted Tamaki Makaurau. And in a way, I believe that's where my mind went after reading your chapter in terms of indigenizing or indigenous ecology and just improving on those aspects. Do you have any thoughts about those kinds of things?
Well, that was a really big wake up call, those floods, because what's interesting about those floods, they happened in areas that were naturally areas where water aggregated. And those were areas which had been covered up by roads, by drains, and had been, in some instances, built on. And they would have been areas that traditionally never would have been built on. And the other thing about our city, the way it's been evolved and been created, is it's a it is we have a whole lot of hard surfaces, and that means that there isn't any ability or porosity in the ground that enables the water to drain through. And also the hard surfaces coupled with the this not a lot of trees or planting, that means that the water just cannot be absorbed. So it was really interesting. Like I was looking at the Wairau Valley, that delta in the North Shore, and that originally was just a huge river delta. And Wairau, 1,000, 100, what does it mean? It means literally 100 waters. And it seems absolutely obvious that that was a critical place for a very big, wide, extensive water system that was covered over, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah, 100%. Even that in itself is a huge debate. I guess just leading even from that, just what you were saying in your chapter, like, do you think those kinds of considerations, or even just the changing of landscape architecture from, like you say, aesthetic setting, to transform into considering those kinds of factors, do you think we are, do you see that, I guess, landscape architecture changing, or
Definitely, because we're now in a climate change emergency, and the issues we're facing now are just the tip of the iceberg of what's going to happen. More catastrophic storms, more flooding, more damage from tornadoes, hurricanes, whatever. We are going to be much more exposed to these different changing weather patterns, and so we are going to have to be rethinking how we mitigate against that when we are designing landscapes for our city. And so we're going to have to also think about what's going to happen, whether our weather patterns are going to get hotter and there's going to be less rain, or they're going to get wetter. So are we going to be needing more shade, or are we going to be needing systems that are able to absorb the water, planting scapes that absorb the water.
I think just with the Te Aranga principles, I'm relatively familiar with them. In university, I got to use them for what were we doing? Sort of reshaping centre place, a little centre place, garden place, a little place here in Kirikiriroa. And I want to say I am not a landscape architect by any means. I'm a planner, so not exactly the most aesthetically pleasing. It was mainly a theoretical thought of mainly garden place in itself, just planting it around as what it should be and sort of revitalizing the area. So, yeah, do you mind just talking a bit more about the Te Aranga principles, if you don't mind?
Well, the Te Aranga principles have got a lot of values that are considered. Like there was a lot of discussion and meeting and hui across the country to gather up what were seemed to be core values that were intrinsic to a lot of different tribal groups. And one of their core values was rangatiratanga, the importance of mana whenua, being able to maintain sovereignty over what happens to their resources, what happens to their food reserves, what happens to their beautiful ngahere forests, what happens to their whenua, which, and that is once something that has been quite seriously undermined as Māori and iwi groups have lost land. So that's one of the important things. There's other important things. One of the values is wairuatanga, which is to do with thinking about our connection to our atua and tau mare. We have a belief that we all are intimately connected to our environments, and the atua are the things that we can't build ourselves, but they're absolutely critical to our survival. Our whenua, papatu anuku, is one of the big atua. She provides us with food. She provides us with a place to live. And that's why she's incredibly revered. And then there are other atua, like the nahiri, tane mahuta, like hine moana, the ocean or tangaroa, depending on where you come from, what district in Aotearoa you come from. And all these atua entities, they're the big entities, but that there are also other entities that are more to do with qualities, but they are essential to maintaining our well-being, especially if we have a balance between how we access and use resources. So that's a mindful of being always respectful and honouring what they give us, which is incredible, life and abundance.
Yeah, definitely. I sort of wish I completely understand what you mean, because ideally Papatūānuku, especially what we do with the whenua, has to give back to her. And you really allude to that within your chapter, as within a Te Ao Māori worldview, we descend from our atua and Papatūānuku especially. So having those kinds of mindsets is really important when developing in different areas, or yeah, mainly in that, not mainly in that space, but wishing that people would have that in mind, because in some sense it's not the case. It's just, oh well, just put something there, that's pretty much it. And if not really, if trying to catch my thoughts up in terms of environmental degradation, you know, like having sort of limits to those is kind of confounding in a Te Ao Māori sense especially. So yeah,
I was thinking about, I had a little read of the Te Aranga principles when I was reflecting on your chapter, because I haven't worked with them before and they're great. But what really struck me was that while I feel like we're perhaps getting better at some of the recognizing of mana, whakapapa, some of the, you know, protection and enhancement and environmental and ecological values and the importance of those functions, the thing that we're perhaps not doing well yet is ahika, right? Both centering mana whenua in their rohi and finding place, you know, for you know, having mana whenua, iwi hapu, actually being able to inhabit their whenua. Right. And then even in terms of the implementation of those values, I mean, we run the risk of sort of taking over that role. So perhaps you could speak a little bit about the distinction between us, you know, as practitioners sort of trying to implement whakapapa and Māori too, and what it actually means to be kaitiakitanga.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that the thing is, with extensive land loss that's occurred in Aotearoa, we've got this issue to do with a lot of internally displaced people, or what I call internal refugees. And the reason why they've become internal refugees is that the lands that they traditionally, where they traditionally lived, for instance, in the areas where my ancestors came from up in the north, my Ngāti Awa ancestors, my Tau Opori ancestors, most of that land was taken by missionaries and taken by people, agents working with the crown. And so there was never enough land left over to sustain the pan-tribal populations up in the north. And most of the people in those areas who've remained have become tenants. And so the thing I think that all of us can do, is that we need to know the history of colonisation, its impact on mana whenua, so we can sort of analyse or assess where mana whenua have gone. We've also got to think about tangata whenua. Tangata whenua are the people who are of this land, but they don't necessarily ancestrally connect to the specific area where they're currently living. And they are huge people in that tangata whenua status. So when we're talking about ahika, it's trying to negotiate, and it's quite a conflicted space, the status between mana whenua who have sovereignty within an area and tangata whenua, their rights as a displaced refugee peoples. So it is a really tricky thing to negotiate that. But our role, all of our role, is to act as allies and advocates. And so that's why it's really important that when we talk about the Te Aranga principles, we're thinking about it not just for Māori, but to educate others about what the principles, what the values that the principles essentially relate to, so that we can have people working as advocates in a professional setting on behalf of Māori, mana whenua and tangata whenua. Because the thing is that working in the built environment, you often don't have mana whenua or tangata whenua well represented in a professional sense. And the thing is, working as a professional, like I work as an architect, and I understand the regulatory environment, the territorial, the Resource Management Act, the Building Act, and I know how it is restricting what Māori can do with their whenua, and I know where the biases lie. Because I understand that, I can say, I can go to the city council, I did that with a papakainga development I did in the north. I can say to the city council, well, where is it in your legislation? Have you allowed for papakainga development under your district regulations? Where are they? How are you supporting tangata whenua from this region? And so that's something that people who are living in the district, they know their problems, but they don't know quite how it's been embedded, structurally embedded within our legislation and district council regulations.
So that kind of relates also to, you made a really interesting observation about colonization, and, you know, because we think of colonization as sort of like a version of immigration, you know, people moving in and, you know, occupying space. But you speak about it as not, obviously, as not something that happened in the past. But the bit that caught my interest was the point you make that it is essentially resource exploitation, that wealth extraction is what colonization really is. And that kind of provides an interesting link to possibly the process of decolonization and the process of making better use of the landscape, just as you were talking about with regard to, you know, redesigning cities and things, to think about this as a place that we want to sustain rather than extract from or make as efficient as possible in order to extract from. So, yeah, sorry, I've sort of run out of a question, but would you want to make a reflection on that? Have you anything to add?
Yeah, that's a good reflection. I mean, basically, we're thinking about who's it for. And, you know, is it for Tauiwi? Is it for Pākehā? Is it for different Māori, iwi, hapu groups as well? And how do they feel like they are being included in the design of our cities? And are they being given that fair access, because a lot of it's to do with equity. Are they being given fair access to housing? Because if they aren't getting the same level or the same access to housing as other groups, that in itself is a problem. And I think we know that Māori are more likely to live in rental accommodation, they're more likely to live in substandard accommodation, more likely than any other ethnic group. So that's again, that's a systemic problem that needs to be addressed, especially when we're dealing with anything that is state-run developments, like the anything that is funded by the government. I think that the Crown and the government have a particular obligation to ensure that Māori have equitable access to resources and the amenities that the rest of Aotearoa society has. And those amenities are really important as well, because what has happened with colonisation is that in the areas where the people still have Māori land, those areas are more marginal and undeveloped. And that means that the communities who live in these areas have less access to infrastructure, less access to education facilities. It's harder to get to a doctor. You have to pay $5 for a litre of milk instead. I don't know. You know, you have to pay more for your 2 litres of milk because you have to travel a lot further. So all those sorts of things are, again, little issues that actually have a long-term impact on those communities, because it locks them in, it tends to lock them into cycles of poverty.
Yeah, and kind of locks them out of urban centres too. I saw in your references you had this rather sad title, "As Cities Grow, So Do the Numbers of Homeless." And I thought, oh gosh, is that really true? And what does that mean? Does that mean that there's a risk that our attempts to solve the housing crisis might actually end up being more colonisation? Yeah.
Well, they tend to be. I mean, one of the things that I've noticed is that we've got we have been growing our cities because we've had a very open immigration policy, and that's to build our economy, essential for building our economy. But in turn, what I'm seeing is that as there's an increased demand for housing in our cities, the housing in cities like Auckland is becoming more and more unaffordable, and people are having to move further and further away to afford to go to university, go to their work. So you're starting to get people who are commuting from Puhoi. I even had a colleague who's been commuting from Ruakaka down to Tamaki to teach at the university. It's sort of slightly crazy. But if that's happening with people who've got jobs and well-paying jobs, how's it affecting people who don't have access to well-paying jobs where they can afford either the travel or the rents or the mortgages for living in a city like Auckland? And, you know, our city, Auckland City or New Zealand housing, is one of the most expensive in the world, in the OECD. It's crazily expensive. And yet we are a city, we're a country with, relatively speaking, not many people, quite a lot of land, and we are a primary producer of products used to build housing. And most of this, the material that's used to build housing is shipped offshore. And we have to pay for global prices to be, and so that in turn means that our housing is 60% more expensive to build a house in Aotearoa than, say, Australia.
Yeah, no, definitely interesting, because like my whānau back at home, just, yeah, we live in quite rural centres, and ideally you don't really see much, I guess, Indigenous presence or Māori presence within the cities. And me and Caroline were talking about this a while ago. And I think in terms of leading the way, I think Ototahi or Christchurch, as well as Tamaki Makaurau, are sort of leading the way in those kinds of efforts. I know Kirikiriro are starting to ramp up, which is really exciting to hear. So, yeah, do you have any comments about just re-Indigenizing cities, city spaces, or creating like a identity or presence within cities of that aspect?
Well, I think I so love driving around Auckland, Tamaki Makaurau now, and being able to see stuff. If I had driven around the city 30 years ago when I was a student, you'd see nothing that told you were of this particular place in Aotearoa. You'd just be driving around and you could almost be in a city in LA. So the moves that have been made in the last, say, 20, 10, 15 years, especially in the landscape, in developing landscapes, has been significant. And it has been really, really wonderful. And I've seen that revitalization of bird life, like going down the Western Motorway, and I sort of look at all the flax growing along the motorway and see the tui in there. 20 years ago, they were never there. So that is magnificent to see those sorts of changes happening, and the beautiful bridges and things that you sort of drive under a bridge and you can, and at night, and you see a tiny fire. It's wonderful. I love it. It makes it a very exciting, wonderful place to live.
Mm.
But it wasn't before that in the same way. It was just, for me, very neutral.
Which may possibly connect into something else that you said in your chapter, which was this idea of the ecology of disciplines, and in terms of teaching and research collaborations, the need for an ecology of disciplines, and can you tell us a little bit about what's happening in this space and why it's so needed, or how you're seeing it outworking as you describe?
Cool. Well, what's happening? We, because of the we're facing a climate change emergency, and also we're facing big social problems and inequality, homelessness, these things that we have understood for quite a long period of time they exist, but we have been incredibly unable to act on those issues in any way. Part of it, I think, is to do with understanding the history of colonization, which once you get a understanding of that, then you are better able to respond. And so I do think I'd really like to see a lot of te tiriti waitangi training and history training. And that will start happening anyway because it's now being taught in the schools. But in terms of this idea of disciplines, when I think of my own discipline, I'm an architect. I mean, architects work within the industry. They tend to only work with a client in a specific site. They're not necessarily understanding or thinking about the wider aspect or impact of their design. So that's to do with how materials are manufactured or extracted from the environment, all the infrastructure, the sewage system, the stormwater systems, the provision of electricity that has to go into the development. Generally, all they're thinking about is just how everything plugs in, but at the boundary of a site. And because we're trying to deal with systemic change, we need to understand what are the wider implications, and we can only really do that. Our brain sort of can only hold so much information, and so we need to draw on the collaborative intelligence of multiple people, experts, who can give us information to influence how we can do things better. I really value that idea of collaborating with others, because that enables whatever I can do to become richer. And it's really interesting. The people you collaborate with can pretty much be anybody. They don't necessarily have to be specialists. Like children are really good collaborators because they will tell you things that you would never have thought about if you didn't get down and to really talk to them about what they want, what they need. So, yeah, thinking about extending your network of collaborators is critical to, I especially talk about children as well, because I think that children are interesting because they inherit the legacy of what we design. And if they don't believe that what we've done for them works for them, that's pretty terrible. And we sort of assume they don't know, but they do know stuff. It's surprising what they know.
And I think it's so important to remember that you're not just talking about playgrounds. You're not just talking about spaces that are specifically designed for children. You're talking about space as a whole, as the entire experience.
Yeah, and how they network with their friends, friend groups, and you know the amenity they get to where they go to hide. They have solitary time, and a connection to say being able to climb a tree or look at birds or whatever. All those things are critically important, because if we can create environments that are abundant with life and biodiversity, that means that the kids will also encounter that the wondrousness of that abundance, and that will, I think it will help make them more caring. I mean, because you can't look at a stick insect as a child and then turn around as an adult and destroy its environment, knowingly destroy its environment, I think. I think you'd be a bit less likely to. I don't know.
Surely.
Yeah, exactly. And I think just to add to that, I'm sure you mentioned it as well, like where the work we do now is what we're doing for our mokopuna and the future generations. I know that 100%. And always having that at the back of your mind is extremely important.
Yeah, the legacy, we think about it as a whakapapa that goes, stretches way back that way and heads way back that way. So there is a long, long reach both ways. And that's the legacy. What is the legacy of what we're creating? And how does it benefit those who have not been born? Because we don't want our future, any of our future descendants, to inherit the mess we're currently in. We need to clean it up. Hard to, but we can. Things, we just got to put a will to it. We've just got to be determined.
Well, I don't know about you, Sarah and Carolyn, but I feel like every time, I swear I say this every time, my brain just grows every time we interview just all these different authors, and just, oh, it's just such a privilege. I know that much. It's absolutely amazing. Also being a confirmation too. Enough. I think that'll wrap us up.
Thank you so much, Fleur.
Yeah, you're awesome. Well,
thank you. Good questions. I enjoyed it.
Okay, we'll wrap up here. Ka kite anō.
This podcast was created by the Landscape Foundation.